It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is the final day of Iowa Week. All week long on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we have been exploring unexpected Iowa. And this hour, unexpected horticulture and plant life on Talk of Iowa. We'll get back to answering your questions about horticulture next Friday. Right now, Iowa mushroom hunters usually head out to the woods in the springtime in search of the reclusive and delectable morel mushroom. But more and more foragers are going mushroom hunting in the fall. Master forager Mike Crabill of Keokuk is back with us. He is a retired teacher and naturalist and a wild food instructor for 50 years. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on air again with you.
Now, as I just said, when I think about mushroom hunting, I think about springtime mushroom hunting. What's out there right now?
We're just beginning to see puffballs coming in, and it's one of the very easy to recognize fall mushrooms. You can simply slice all the way down from the top to the bottom and dip it in onion ring batter and fry them up, dip them in a dollop of ranch dressing or honey barbecue sauce, and they are delectable. Another one that's easy to see, it never hides from you like the elusive morel, is the chicken mushroom or the sulfur shelf. It is bright orange on top and has yellow margins, and then it's yellow underneath. You can see it blocks away in the woods. And sometimes at this time of the year, I actually carry binoculars along to save myself going up and down hills, in pursuit of this mushroom.
It's such a bright color that you can see it from that far away.
Oh, absolutely. It's a delicious eating mushroom if you know how to cook it up. There's a white poured chicken of the woods that looks very much similar, except it grows in a rosette. Instead of up on logs or on the trunk of a tree, it grows in a rosette at the base of trees, oak trees, and it has white edges, and a white underside. But the surface of this, like the petals of a rose, the surface is kind of a creamsicle orange. I don't know if you remember creamsicles that had that pale orange, but it also is quite a find and very, very tender.
Now, we talk all the time in the spring about everybody swaps ideas about where you would find the morel mushrooms. Are the mushrooms you've mentioned so far, are there very different environments for each of them, or do you just go out in the woods and cross
both,
your fingers?
Right. They're both associated with oak trees, and Iowa has lots and lots of oak trees, and so you simply head into the woods, and you're going to find these two. The sulfur shelf, the one with the yellow edges and the bright orange top, will grow up on the tree or on logs. And the other one, the white poured chicken of the woods, or also known as the chicken mushroom, will grow at the base of oak trees, but not up on logs and not up on the tree itself.
When I think about puffball mushrooms, I think about how much fun I had as a kid finding the ones that were in their later stage and stomping on them, making all the spores come out and puff all over the place. Do you have to catch them at the right time?
Exactly so. Very important. These can be easily seen and recognized. They look like somebody left a volleyball on a lawn, in a pasture, or sometimes into the woods under some brush. They have that same volleyball shape and same volleyball size, although it will range from softball size to even larger than a volleyball. And to make sure it's safe to eat and at the prime time to harvest, you need to take a knife and cut from the top down to where it's attached to the soil. And if it looks like white cream cheese or a giant marshmallow all the way through, it's fine.
Okay.
If there's any hint of yellow or green starting to kind of decompose and form the spores inside, it may smell pretty nasty and it might make you sick. The other thing that often happens with a giant puffball is that it will get flies laying eggs through the skin. And if you see little pinholes on the outside of the skin, You want to start suspecting that there might be something down inside that is white and wiggly, the same color, as a puffball. Some of my students, I taught school for 35 years, and kids would frequently bring in puffballs in the fall. And we'd slice down through them, and we had a garage sale electric frying pan, and I had some onion ring batter in a package mix in the cabinet, and the kids would mix up the onion ring batter with a little bit of water and dip these in there and then deep fry them in some canola oil until they were light golden brown and rolled them over. And they got very good at it. And I remember one time especially when one of the students was chowing down on her pieces and turned to look at her friends. And she turned back to look at the piece before she set it in her mouth, and she saw something white and wiggly.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. And she screamed, and everybody said, "What's wrong?" And she told them, and they got stuck in the doorway running towards the bathroom. So.
Okay, so there's a cautionary tale. You know, I've eaten puffball mushrooms before, and
yes,
they are so large. In fact, I saw a friend of mine, he put up a picture on Facebook of all of the puffballs that he'd already harvested this fall, and my son looked at it and he said, "Why is he so proud of all those rocks?" Because they were really big.
Yeah.
But you can get so much from a puffball mushroom, so much that maybe you can't even eat it all. Is there a way to store them?
Not very well. They, in my experience, they don't freeze well. They don't dry especially well. I think the best way to handle it is to go ahead and dry them and then grind them up in a coffee mill or a blender or a food processor and get them to the powder stage. Even a regular blender would work fine. And then you can use the powder to thicken soups or stews or whatever, to add flavor and nutrition. So that's one of my suggestions, because they're so easy to recognize and it's unlikely that you would ever confuse it with anything else. The young mushroom of many species, especially the deadly Amanita, the destroying angel, comes up looking kind of like an egg. And so if the mushroom is fairly small and white, and you think it might be a puffball, still, if you slice down through from the top to the bottom, and if you see the gills inside or the parts of a stem, you know, whoops, that's not a puffball. Again, it has to look like white cream cheese or a big marshmallow when you cut it open.
Now, just talking about the possible mistakes that you could make, and when you were describing the sulfur shelf, the bright color, that sort of just screams danger to me when you're thinking about eating something that you're foraging. What do you need to do to prepare yourself if you want to go foraging for mushrooms and you want to stay safe? Because obviously there are dangers out there.
There are some dangers out there, but I liken it to going shopping in a large, let's say, super Walmart that has food and it also has a hardware section. And if you are starting to describe something that you have not seen before and it's in the hardware section and it's a liquid and it's clear, whoops. So the habitat sometimes makes a difference, but also the characteristics. And that characteristics, I think, is a key word here. If the mushroom has 12 different characteristics that help it be distinguished from all other mushrooms, all 12 of those have to be true of the specimen that you're looking at, or you have a different mushroom. We have 3,000 to 5,000 different species of mushrooms in the Midwest. And they can be told apart, but you don't want to force the identification. You want to make sure it completely meets every single description. For instance, if I said I'm thinking of a food item that is perfectly spherical and it is found, well, I won't tell you where it's found in this superstore, but it's orange. Immediately to your mind comes something that you've seen before, you've experienced before, the orange itself. And the same thing is true of mushrooms. I can look at mushrooms because I've seen them for years and I've gone through the characteristics, and so can other members of our mushroom club. And so one of the things that you can do that will help you is to go on a foray on a mushroom hunt with experienced people. However, if they give you some mushrooms to take home, it is still your responsibility to make sure that all of the characteristics match. Mushroom club members have been known to make mistakes when they first see a mushroom, and then they look up the characteristics and they say, whoops, that's not that. This is the other one, because the characteristics match. There are some really good books out there that you can go to. A couple that came out this year, as a matter of fact, Mushrooms of the Upper Midwest by Teresa Maroney and Kathy Yurich, and Mushrooms of the Midwest by Michael Kuo and Andrew Methvin. And then there's another really, really good one called The Edible Wild Mushrooms of Illinois and Surrounding States, A Field to Kitchen Guide, and it also talks about the cooking aspects, and that's by Joe McFarland and Gregory Mueller, M-U-E-L-L-E-R. So looking at more than one reference, again, because we've got 3,000 to 5,000 species out there, you're not going to be able to have all of the species in one book. And so it's helpful to have several references that you can go to, either in a library or in a bookstore or wherever.
I'm talking with Master Forager Mike Krabill of Keokuk. If you want to join the conversation, if you have questions for Mike, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mike will be with us for the next 8 minutes or so, so get your questions in fast if you want to talk to him. And Mike, with all the years that you have spent foraging and teaching other people how to forage, do you know someone who has made a very serious mistake with mushrooms?
You know, that's the answer is absolutely not. There are a lot of the urban legends out there about the supposed mushroom expert that taught mycology at a university who poisoned himself by making a mistake. That's an urban legend. It's repeated over and over and over again. And I've had people on Facebook, for instance, tell me that same story, and I said, okay, I might believe it if you can tell me the name of the university, the name of the professor, point me to his obituary, you know, but nobody can verify it. It's just one of those stories that gets passed from person to person to person. All of us who have had experience with mushrooms realize the danger inherent in trying to eat something that we think is true. Okay, we absolutely have to verify it. And it's not hard. It's just that all the characteristics of that particular mushroom must match.
We have Dennis on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Dennis.
Yes.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is the characteristics of truffles around the Cedar Rapids area. I live in Robbins, and I've unearthed some things that when I cut into them, they have the appearance of truffles. And when I Google images, they appear to be truffles, but I'm not sure because them being a fungus and all, I don't want to be the one to taste them and find out for sure.
Right. You don't want to be that story that we're talking about. Are there truffles around here, Mike?
Oh, yes. There's certainly truffles in Iowa. And I'm pleased that Dennis has been able to find some of them. I happen to have on my bookshelf behind me, and I've just stood up to reach it, A Field Guide to North American Truffles. And the problem is that most of the truffles that are out there, the edibility, you know, may be marked as inedible, or it might be marked as tasty or whatever. But and here's one that says insipid. So you need one, a book that has photos with it, so that you, when you cut your truffle open, there's a pattern inside the truffle. And it really helps to see the color and the pattern and to know what tree this was associated with. So if you are able to recognize whether it's an oak tree, an elm tree, or whatever, that is also helpful, Dennis.
All right. Well, Dennis, good luck with that. That was the Field Guide to North American Truffles. And truffles are a kind of mushroom, right?
They are, uh-huh, an underground mushroom. And most of them have some association with specific trees and or mycorrhizal with them. And mycorrhizal simply means that the mycelium of the truffle itself connects with the root hairs of the neighboring tree. And basically what the truffle does is that it provides minerals, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium especially, which is basically fertilizer, and it causes the tree to grow ever so much faster and better. And in exchange, the tree provides carbohydrates that are made through photosynthesis and feeds that on down to the truffle. So it's a pairing that is beneficial for both.
And we have time for one more call here. Here's RJ in Urbandale. Hi, RJ.
Hi, I'll make it real quick. I'm from an Italian family. Back in the old days, my dad used to hunt elephant ears. Did you mention elephant ears?
No, I haven't mentioned elephant ears. Elephant ears, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be mistaken because common names sometimes get us in trouble, and it's useful to have scientific names. But the plant that I understand is elephant ears is grows during morel season, and it has kind of a brownish color to it, but it's smooth and very large and flat and somewhat reminiscent of an elephant's ears.
Okay, I just want to tell you how you preserve them.
Oh, well, good. Go ahead.
They're called Mulangianis. The Italians call it Mulangiani, and what they do is they cut them up. They put them in oil, garlic, olives, different peppers, and that's how they preserve them.
Excellent.
Right.
Excellent.
You put them out like a little salad.
Well, it sounds delicious. RJ, thank you so much for your call. And Mike, we have just 1 minute left, and I want to mention the Prairie States Mushroom Club has some foraging events coming up just this weekend.
Yes, it does. However, those are filled, unfortunately.
Oh, they're all full. Okay.
Is there
more interest in this than there has been? You've been teaching people to do this for half a century.
It's growing by leaps and bounds. It truly is, especially with the advent of Facebook groups, and there must be a dozen different ones on mushrooms alone and mushroom identification, as well as wild foods. The McFarland Park, north of Ames, 25 people are the limit, and we've got 25 filled and 20 on the waiting
list. Wow, so people are excited about this. Well, Mike, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My honor to do so. You're certainly welcome, and I'm happy to share what I know.
Well, thanks a lot. I'm sure we'll talk again. Mike Crabill is a master forager. He is a retired teacher and naturalist. He's also been a wild food instructor for 50 years. This hour, we're exploring unexpected horticulture on Talk of Iowa. We'll continue in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, but because this is Iowa Week and we've been exploring unexpected Iowa all week, we're doing something a little bit different this hour and exploring unexpected horticulture and plant life in Iowa. My next guest is Tom Wall. He is a farmer, but his farm looks very different from any other I've ever seen. There are no fields of corn and soybeans. There are no fields of carrots or kale. Tom grows and sells trees, and he harvests and sells the crops that come from some of those trees. His farm is Red Fern Farm near Wapello, and he's on the line with us now. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Now, tell me how this started for you. How did you get the idea of producing crops in Iowa that really nobody else was producing?
Well, that's actually a long, boring story.
Well, make it short and relatively interesting, Tom.
Well, in short, my educational background is natural resource conservation, and I realized that a lot of the problems that professionals in my field were dealing with were a direct result of agriculture, and I decided what I should do is reinvent agriculture in a form that doesn't cause all those problems.
So you decided to have a different kind of farm, and on your farm you have a number of different kinds of crops. Tell us what you grow.
Well, that's a really long list. More than 50 species of nuts and fruits on trees, shrubs, and vines, but our main crop is chestnut, but also persimmon, pawpaw, Asian pear, aronia berry, and the heart nut are all also important parts. Then there's a very long list of experimental crops.
Now, I've visited your chestnut grove, which is a fascinating place to be. Of course, most of us know the story of the American chestnuts, and that's why we don't grow chestnuts more often in this country. You're growing Chinese chestnuts.
Correct. Although some of them are hybrids between Chinese and American.
All right. And because they're hybrids, they can survive here.
Yes. If they have enough Chinese genes in them, then they're resistant to the blight that killed the American chestnut.
And what made you think, hey, I bet I could grow chestnuts in Iowa?
Well, it started with a magazine article I read in, I can't even remember the name of the magazine. It was a small farm magazine about 30 years ago, and it suggested raising chestnuts as an alternative crop. And I'd always been interested in chestnuts since I'd heard the story of the American chestnut in the third grade. And I decided to give it a try.
And you grow a lot of chestnuts, but you can't meet demand for chestnuts here.
No, in fact, nobody in North America can meet demand for chestnuts. In fact, I've been telling people if demand for chestnuts remains perfectly flat from now on, instead of doubling in every 10 years as it has been, at the rate we're planting chestnut trees nationwide, it will still take about 285 years before we have enough trees in the ground to grow enough chestnuts to meet the demand we had back in the year 2000, 14 years ago.
Wow. People really want chestnuts. And you also sell chestnut seedlings, right?
Yes.
And you can't keep up with demand for those either?
I'm sold out of those right now.
How long do you have to wait? Once you plant a chestnut tree, how long do you have to wait before you have a crop?
A minimum of 2 years, but average is more like 3 to 5 years to the first nut production.
It's one of the things that strikes me about the crops that you grow is that you are looking at farming at a much longer scale, looking much farther into the future than most other farmers.
Yes.
That sounds difficult financially because you have to plan so far ahead, but I would also think it takes a lot of patience.
Yes, it does. Anybody who plants trees needs patience. But you can start small and grow gradually so that there isn't such a financial burden before you see a first return.
You mentioned some of the different kinds of crops that you grow, and I'm just looking through your catalog, and I see hardy northern pecans, and you mentioned the pawpaws and persimmons, grafted Asian pears, aronia berries. You're growing a really wide variety of things that a lot of us wouldn't even think of as being something we could grow in Iowa. Tom, do you think we need to take a much broader view of what we can grow and diversify in this state?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Almost any crop can have a bad year, and if you have all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, and you have a bad year for that crop, it can be financial disaster for some people. But if you have 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 different crops growing all together, even if several of them have a bad year, you still have something to fall back on.
Tom, you were thinking of and attempting to do something very different when you started farming. In selling these seedlings and talking to other farmers, you've been reaching a lot of people with your ideas. Do you find that there are other farmers in Iowa who are following suit, following your example?
Well, as a matter of fact, most of the people who become interested in these kinds of crops are not the traditional corn and soybean farmers, but mm-hmm. they're people with small farms, small vegetable farmers, also just people like doctors and lawyers and dentists and people who have a piece of rural land that they may or may not be living on and are just looking for something to do with it.
Yesterday, I was just outside Grinnell, and I was looking at a grove of young trees, and I stared and stared for a long time thinking, what on earth are those? And it finally dawned on me, that's a grove of chestnut trees. And then I thought of you, and I thought, I'll bet there's a connection. Do you find that a lot more people in Iowa are planting chestnuts?
Yes, it's been picking up the last 6 years or so.
And one of the things that was really fun about that is that chestnut trees are very strange looking, and it sort of looked like a grove out of a Dr. Seuss story.
Well, they don't look strange to me, but then I see them every day.
Well, I think you're doing your part for sure to diversify the Iowa landscape.
I'm working on it.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for talking with me again.
You're welcome.
Tom Wall is a farmer. He farms at Red Fern Farm near Wapello. He grows chestnuts, Chinese chestnuts, aronia berries, persimmons, pawpaws, and all kinds of other interesting crops here in Iowa. We're talking about unexpected horticulture this hour. And on Horticulture Day, we get a lot of phone calls about peach trees. And the calls lately go something like this. The caller says, I have peach trees and they died. And then Richard Duran says something like, yeah, that happens a lot. Tim Shriver, against the odds, has planted an entire orchard of peaches near West Branch. He is one of very few commercial peach growers in Iowa. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
So that sounds like not necessarily the most practical plan to plant an orchard of peach trees in Iowa. How did this happen?
Well, I guess I'll just have to go up against Richard Duran, and he's the expert, and I'm the experimenter in this situation. I am aware of the challenges of growing peaches more and more as I go along, but I've also consulted with Patrick O'Malley at the Extension Service, and he has been actually quite encouraging about the prospects of having a peach crop most years.
So, is there a particular variety that you've planted?
Well, I did a lot of research to identify the varieties that had the best prospects in Iowa. And there were four that I came up with. One that is new around 2005 or so that was heralded as having better prospects in this climate.
And what are the varieties that you grow, if you don't mind sharing?
Oh, the new one is called PF24C, cold hardy. It's part of a line by Paul Friday. The other three are Contender, Madison, and Gloria. Gloria is also a new patented variety.
When did you start planting peach trees?
Well, in 2011, I was looking for an opportunity in the local food market and trying to think of something that nobody else was planting. And when I found out that peach trees theoretically could be grown in our hardiness zone, I started doing some research, and it didn't look undoable. So I planted our first 100 trees in 2011, and they grew so vigorously that the initial results were encouraging. So I planted 400 more the next year. And then by last year, I finally tasted a peach. And when I tasted that first peach right off the tree in my orchard, I knew I was on the right track. If the peaches survive, a peach picked just off the tree is so much better than anything you can buy in a grocery store around here that it's continued to seem like an experiment worth trying.
What was your reaction when you bit into that first peach?
Well, one thing I noticed was how aromatic it was. I mean, it smelled wonderful and so much sweeter, and it had none of that mushy quality that is familiar to anybody who's trying to buy a good peach in Iowa. It because it's allowed to fully ripen on the tree, it's got the full flavor of a truly ripe peach, whereas if you buy a peach in the store, frequently them in pick when they're quite hard. And while they soften up, they don't ever really quite ripen. I think everybody's had that experience of getting a peach that looks nice, but you get it home and it's a big disappointment. And it was that experience that really turned me on to the idea of growing peaches in the first place, because I mean, I kept complaining I couldn't get a decent peach. And so, well, how about if we grow some?
Or 500 trees worth of
them.
So how many trees do you have now?
1,350.
1,350 trees. Are you in an area that is somewhat sheltered? Is there anything special about the land that you're planting on?
The main thing is that it's well-drained. It's on a slope that allows the cold air to drain in the spring, which is critical for avoiding a late spring frost, which can kill the flower buds. It gives you a little bit of leeway on that because the cold air drains down to the bottom of the hill. There are plenty of challenges here, and the naysayers may very well be proven right because I must say this last winter with the polar vortex was the most discouraging experience.
I'm sure, especially coming right after your first real peach crop.
That's
then
right.
We have the coldest winter we've had in at least 25 years, if not longer.
Probably 35.
Right.
Yeah.
So how did that affect your peaches for this year?
Well, it was a mixed bag. I was afraid that the trees would die outright, and that is exactly what happened in some other peach-growing regions in the Midwest. I was just reading yesterday that there were orchards in Michigan where they lost entire acres of trees.
Mm-hmm.
The experience I had was more typical of the orchards that lost flower buds. My trees survived, and there was some winter kill on especially the new growth. But the trees themselves are alive, but no peaches this year because below about minus 15 or so, the peach buds do not survive the winter, and you just have nice leafy bushes.
So have you been planting more trees yet this summer?
We plant our last trees this spring.
Okay.
We've planted as many as we're going to do and wait and see what happens.
And it's been a good growing season, I would expect, for the trees you planted spring.
We got 8 inches of rain in 9 days.
Okay.
In June.
Maybe that was a bit much.
Yeah, and so that peach trees don't like that either. They were getting pretty soggy, and that can cause root rot, and too much rain causes a bacterial spot on the leaves, and usually you lose some foliage. When the weather straightened out and we finally got some nice, dry, warm weather, they've just really come to life. And I think the trees we planted this year look better than any I've ever seen. They've just doubled in size and just look fantastic.
Now, often with, for example, apples, you know, we had an amazing apple year last year. This year, not as many apples. The apple trees in my yard have nothing
mm-hmm.
on them. Are peaches like that typically? Do you have a bumper crop 1 year and then not much the next year?
Yeah, they seem to be. I mean, I've only had the experience with growing one crop so far.
Well, certainly you have the extreme of that this time.
Certainly have seen that they are sensitive to a lot of things. I mean, the weather being the biggest one. Like last year, we had an absolute infestation of Japanese beetles, and this year I didn't see really a single one. Well, maybe a handful of them. But so why did was I being denuded last year by Japanese beetles and this year not? I don't know. But it's that kind of thing that's thrown at you all the time. In June we're getting drowned out, and then last 2 years before that we spent most of our time watering.
Well, I certainly hope that, for a lot of reasons, I hope that this coming winter is not nearly as severe as last winter. And Tim, I hope you have a crop next summer. I can't wait to find out how it goes.
Well, I've got my fingers crossed, and I'm hoping that this winter was an outlier and not the new normal.
You and everyone else.
The USDA just switched us half a zone south right before I did this, so they seem to think warmer winters were more likely, and I guess I'm going to keep counting on that.
All right. Well, Tim, thank you very much for talking with me.
Glad to do it.
Tim Shriver is a commercial peach grower, if he gets another crop, near West Branch. This hour, we've been exploring unexpected horticulture and plant life. Next Friday, we will be back to our regular routine of answering your questions. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be here to talk about fall color, and horticulturist Richard Geron will be on the air to answer your questions as well. This has been Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa, the final Iowa Week program coming up on River to River today with an Iowa Week news buzz at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.